But you did it early and accurately.
Thank you.
I guess we now have the tape recorder on, and just for the record, the Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission, we're interviewing Robert Leighton at the Kauffman Foundation. This is Kim Schaefer. There's also Greg Feldberg, Jane
Poulin,
Mike Easterly. And I think we acknowledge your early writings and contributions about the causes of the financial crisis. I think today, if we could, we'd like to focus more specifically on, at least initially, on derivatives.
Okay.
And if you have this paper, although to a large extent it's more prescriptive, and if we could back up in a sense and talk about derivatives as a cause of the financial crisis and your views on that, that would be really helpful.
Okay. So let me step back and sort of just give you my broad, simplistic framework. If I were in your position in writing a report, even though I know that the Congress has instructed you to look at like 18 separate causes of the crisis, I think it's a lot easier to construct the narrative around, you know, a very limited set of themes and then work all the 18 causes into those themes. Only because, you know, applying Occam's razor, you know, people don't like to read laundry lists of 18 things, but like, I think, a much, you know, tighter narrative. And so when I give talks about the crisis, I analogize it to a forest fire, and I talk about the match that lit the fire, and then I talk about the gasoline on the floor of the forest fire that enabled the match to explode and almost burn down the entire forest. So that's the analogy that I use. And so So basically, think about the match and the gasoline, okay? So the match is too much subprime lending, and there are a lot of reasons why that happened, and you can throw a lot of the 18 causes into that. And then the gasoline is leverage, and that's why it nearly brought down the whole financial system. So I think if you think of it that way, it really dramatically simplifies things.
Yep.
When you think about derivatives played a role, I guess, in both of those things. They clearly allowed, I think they allow more leverage by financial institutions because under the risk-weighted system, if you had, a CDS protecting your asset, you know, your MBS or whatever it was, I think you got a lower risk weight, so you were able to leverage your institution more. Whether it's inside the bank or in a SIB or you're an investment bank or whatever it is, CDSs allow more leverage. All right? So that's one way to think about CDSs. And then on the origination side of subprime debt, certainly, there are a lot of things that enabled subprime debt to get originated. But certainly CDS helped play a role in that too, because it gave comfort to the rating agencies that this stuff was going to be okay. So that's conceptually how I would treat it.
Do you mind playing out the latter point a little bit more?
Okay. All right. So you can start from the beginning, and you can run a timeline, and it'd probably be useful to do it in the report of, you know, the origination process, where you've got the originator, who is primarily mortgage banks and subsidiary, of course, are banks themselves. We all know that most of the originators were not banks. So you had the originators. They then sold to the securitizers. And in order for the securitizers to sell to the next party down the line, which would have been the investors, they had to do a number of things in that second box, the securitizers. They had to obviously structure the deal and tranche it and make sure that it was going to be done that way. But in addition, in order to get that AAA piece, AAA'd, and here I'm relying heavily, of course, on Jill and Ted's great book. The first CDS was written, I think it was by AIG, right? I think I wrote the first one. JP Morgan. She talks about JP Morgan went to AIG. and I think got the first CDS. Or I could have been wrong. Maybe AIG came later. But to make a long story short, she has a lengthy treatment in there of how J.P. Morgan figured out that the way to basically make the ratings agencies happy was to get a CDS, at least I think on the top tranche, on the AAA piece, and that's how they got AAA. By the way, a substitute for CDS, of course, would have been bond insurance. I mean, they did the same thing. So conceptually, I think that's how it happened. Does that help?
Okay. Do you want to differentiate between derivatives related to mortgages and derivatives related to corporate debt?
Yeah, I think that's a really important point because I have a footnote in my report, which I got from some document I can't remember, but basically most all the derivatives are not mortgage related. So, you know, most of the blame that's been directed at CDS sort of assumes, even for example, when you read The Big Short, which is obviously the best book ever written, I think it's the best book ever written about Wall Street, my own opinion. You know, and I'm sure a lot of other people agree with me. And, you know, if you read The Big Short, you get the impression that the whole CDS market was cooked up for mortgages. And it wasn't. You know, I think CDS, the initial CDS, which I think started in the late 1980s or whatever, was aimed at corporates. They aimed at corporate loans and eventually went to bonds and so forth. And I think, you know, by sheer volume, over 90% of the CDSs are on corporate names or on corporate indexes. So that mortgages are really a small part of the CDS market. That's why, you know, even though I end up in my paper in derivatives dealers market saying, you know, we ought to have clearing and exchanges for all for all standardized CDSs, it's important, I think, to put CDSs for mortgage in their proper perspective, because they are not the dominant form of CDS.
Have you seen any studies or any data about losses in the corporate CDS market?
That's a very good question. No, I haven't. I only know sort of indirect. The short answer is no. I'm sure there have been a few losses because I think some junk bonds went south, but I don't know whether the junk bonds had CDS on them or not. Well, actually, we do know. Wait a minute. We do know. I mean, one good place to start would be to find out somehow, some way, what losses were taken on the GM CDSs. Because I know there were CDSs written on GM and probably Chrysler debt, too.
Well, and Icelandic banks.
Yeah,
To name other possibilities.
Right. But that would be the most prominent one.
So you said the two things. You said derivatives were involved in as both the match and the gasoline. Can you say a little bit more about the gasoline?
Yeah, so basically, my understanding is, you know, that, now again, this all depends, you know, under the Basel II system, which basically, and this is, by the way, an interesting question. Basel II actually, as you know, never fully became effective until right around the time the crisis happened.
Mm-hmm.
But my understanding is that since the basic structure of Basel II was out there for most of the decade, banks were already, throughout the decade, trying to comply with Basel II, you know, in anticipation that it was going to be effective. So that gave incentives for banks. As you know, under Basel II, it's all complicated, that basically under the standardized approach, you rely on rating agencies to develop the risk buckets. And then under the sophisticated approach, you're allowed to use your own internal models. And something that I've been hazy on is the extent to which banks in the pre-crisis era would have known that they were going to be approved to use the internal models as opposed to the risk weights. But certainly as a fallback, they knew that the risk weights were going to be used.
Mm-hmm.
And if they weren't going to get the internal models approved, And so under the risk weighting system, as you know, the more stuff you had that was AAA, then you had a lower risk weight. I think it was, what, a 20% risk weight or whatever. And if you could get a 20% risk weight rather than 100% risk weight, that's great. Then you could do 5 times the leverage, and CDSs would have allowed you to turn 100% risk-weighted assets or 50% risk-weighted assets, because I think mortgages would have been 50%. It would have allowed you to turn, you know, 50% mortgage risk weights into 20% risk weights. So that's why I think, you know, the banks would have been eager to do this. Totally apart from the SIBs. Now, of course, a whole separate subject is, you know, how and when they created the SIBs as a way to get all the stuff off the balance sheet and not have to worry about the risk base. But as long as you had the stuff on the balance sheet, then it paid to have, you know, the 20% risk weight.
Can I just clarify what you're talking about for SIBs? Because some people talk about SIBs as the most extreme structure of the special purpose entity. Sounds like you're using the term a little bit more broadly.
No, I'm just meaning the, you know, I'm meaning it in the sense in which Citibank and I don't know how many other banks used structured investment vehicles. And it's important, obviously, in your narrative to nail down exactly when the first one of these was developed and, you know, sort of when they took off. And, you know, one of the narratives that I've never understood, I haven't been able in a position like you guys to ask questions, is why the regulators took such a benign attitude towards SIBs, or A, whether they even knew about them. I mean, I've been at conferences where, you know, I don't think I've gotten a straight answer whether regulators knew about them, or if they knew about them, they said they weren't worried about them, you know, et cetera. And, you know, I mean, one easy cop-out for the regulators to say, well, we shouldn't have been worried about them, is that technically the SIBs would have, you know, complied with the new FASB rules on special purpose entities because they were constructed that way.
Right.
And so the regulators can say, look, if it complies with FASB and it's off balance sheet, we don't really care about it.
The new rules at the time, you mean? Not the new rules currently.
That's why I asked,
because all these other structures are, for example, Citigroup has a very structure, their mortgage securitizations have been around for a long, long time, and then you move from there all the way down to the SIBs, and it gets to be a little bit more exotic and unclear what the assets are. But a SIB and a CEO, to me, are relatively, we're talking about the same thing, except for maybe with the types of assets that are in it.
Yeah, that's true, although my understanding is that before there was a SIB, and if you had a CDO, some of the banks kept some of the tranches of the CDO on their balance sheet, and you know, if they couldn't sell them.
Right. So the SIBs are different. The SIBs are different in that the banks, I don't think, retained interest. But I don't know as though where they retained interest in every other special purpose vehicle that was off balance sheet that they structured.
No, I mean, you mean that the banks had no interest, no equity interest in the SIB, right?
As far as I know. But then if you look at some of the other structures,
okay, that's right. However, my understanding of the standard SIB is that there was a line of credit, typically, agreement between the bank and the SIB.
Mm-hmm.
The bank would provide line of credit to the SIB if it needed it. So there was an umbilical cord there between the two of them.
Yeah, there's some sort of relationship between the bank and the other ones. That's why I only ask, because if you look at all of Citigroup's portfolio, even if you exclude the mortgage and credit card and student loan securitizations, the SIBs are a very small piece of what's off balance sheet. And some of the major financial institutions, I don't think they involve themselves in SIBs even as much as Citigroup did. It's just Citi's made a big splash in the market.
Well, that was it.
Yeah, and versus, you know, everybody calls them SIBs now, but point in time when they structured these other vehicles, they were doing the same type of thing. They're structuring around the accounting rules.
Right, although, you know, again, my knowledge here is imperfect. I know that when they tried to do the super SIB, there were a lot of articles around that time that indicated that the total liabilities of all the SIBs was around $400 billion.
That's right.
Oh, right, the treasury.
So it had to be a lot of... There had to be a lot of, quote, SIB stuff out there.
Yeah,
but that was it, just for to pick up SIB stuff. Yeah, I think it was a lot of it. But that is the right number for how much the SIBs were.
Yeah. And I think, and by the way, I have to confess something. I'm sure I'm like a lot of other people, you know. I didn't know a lot about SIBs until the thing blew up. I never even knew they existed. You know, and so the only reason I raised the question is I just wonder when the regulators knew about them. You know, that's an important question.
I think they probably made the same mistake as the rating agencies. They thought that it was enough liquidity backstop and that it was bankruptcy remote.
Right, right. But if I'm right that the SIBs had this umbilical cord and the banks were on the hook to provide a line of credit in case they got liquidity problems, I mean, while that's technically maybe in compliance with the new rules on the new FASB rules on special purpose entities, that to me is a red flag to regulators saying, holy cow, I don't care that the bank has no equity interest in the SIB. The bank could basically could find itself in a position where it has to shell out a whole bunch of money to these things. And so just from a prudential point of view, maybe I want to have the bank, reserve some capital against that or at least think about that problem.
So is your concern with the SIBs that there's no retained interest, so therefore it never gets picked up in the capital ratios?
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah. Yeah. I mean, my understanding is that the SIBs were created as a way to get this stuff off balance sheet, so they didn't. It's a way to circumvent, you know, the capital rule.
Yeah, and it's probably the most extreme structure versus the other structures. Arguably, do the same thing.
Yes.
If there's a retained interest, there's some risk weighting. For the off-balance sheet exposure, but I think that's really small as well. But you're right.
Right.
The SIBs, if they had no retained interest, there would be nothing in the capital.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay.
Got it. I understand your point now. Sorry for all that.
This morning I read the Derivatives Dealer Club article, and it was really very enlightening and helpful to me. I mean, I guess this is obviously something very important for us to look at. We've had conversations with the New York Fed and a few others, so we've kind of got a start already, but there was a lot in here that I just didn't know. And,
thank you very much. It took a lot of work, and I had some very useful sources, and it took a lot of work.
I guess I'm glad to hear that.
Yeah, because I'm going to tell you, this stuff, you know, I sort of scoured the literature on this stuff, and I downloaded everything that I could. Mm-hmm. And it was either so opaque that I couldn't understand it, and I needed to have it explained to me, or I had to go talk to people who actually were in the market. Now, I have to confess, of course, you know, I was kind of upstaged by, you know, The Big Short. The Big Short, I said, is a phenomenal book. Mm-hmm. But he didn't get into a lot of the technical issues, obviously, that I ended up getting into. So,
yeah, no. Okay.
And you didn't quite make as much money.
No, I made no money. And I'm not as good a writer as he is.
So Brookings articles don't sell well.
They don't do that. And you know what? That's eventually going to be a movie. And they'll figure out a way to make a movie out of it, I'm sure.
But I guess this should be the last question rather than the first, but since you brought it up. So who was helpful in this? Who should we contact next?
Well, I don't know whether I should. I don't know. I feel comfortable divulging my sources.
Okay, that's fine.
I think they talked to me off the record. So
okay.
Okay.
So the first broad question is, you know, you make a very eloquent case that the dealer cartel has an impact on pricing and it's disadvantageous to end users. But I guess I could make up a story, but could you help me kind of tell a story about how this played a role in the crisis?
Oh, yeah. I think that it did not play a, you know, as huge a role as, for example, one would assume by just reading The Big Short. All right. That's my only point. I think the media have given derivatives a lot more blame for this crisis than maybe they deserve. But nonetheless, I guess the thrust of my argument in the Derivatives Club was largely forward-looking, you know, mm-hmm. that, you know, it could blow up again, and, I don't want it to blow up again, so that's sort of, you know, where I was led to make those recommendations. Plus, I made a separate antitrust argument that it was to the detriment of the users, the way it's currently structured, which is independent of the crisis. It's just an opaque, opacity and transparency is not good for users.
Yeah, I mean, you kind of said that at one point that the end users don't make a successful political force for some reason. But is that part of the problem?
Yeah, I mean, I think. Look, I understand. I mean, I think there's the reason for the. I mean, clearly there's a tragedy of the commons problem here, or a public good problem where each individual end user does not want to post margin, and I understand that. But each end user is not taking account of the externality that they impose on the rest of the system if all of it goes down. And so I understand why large individual end users don't want to post collateral. But, you know, that's sort of like saying why rich people don't want to pay taxes. You know, mm-hmm. Same argument.
This is a terrific history of kind of how the market's been working in the last couple of years. But I guess what I don't understand is before that was, you've got the history of CME and ICE and DTCC, you know,
right.
Recently. But how were trades done pre-09?
All over the count. Oh, you mean before we had a central clearinghouse?
Yeah.
Okay, well, the first thing is that even with a central clearinghouse, my understanding, and even today, I don't think the facts have changed.
Mm-hmm.
Today, a certain volume of bank-to-bank derivatives are cleared through ICE.
Mm-hmm.
I think today CME still hardly has any business.
Right.
And before ICE came along, there was no central clearing, and basically Bank A, let's say J.P. Morgan doing a deal with Bank of America, mm-hmm. there would be no central clearing, and they would just rely on each other. And I do make the argument, I think it's true, that one of the reasons for the concentration among the top five is that each of the top five thought that the other was too big to fail. So they knew that they were going to get paid. I think that certainly contributed to the concentration.
Mm-hmm. So now that ICE Trust has come along, I guess ICE Trust was kind of pushed along by the New York Fed?
Yes, it was. And New York Fed was very much behind, pushing as much as it felt it was capable, from what I can gather. Because
mm-hmm.
first, let's roll the clock back probably 3 or 4 years ago.
Yeah, that would help.
So 3 or 4 years ago, my understanding is, go back to like 2005, 2006,
mm-hmm.
when Tim Geithner was at the Fed in New York, he called, I mean, basically, and the guy, by the way, the guy who knows more about this at the Fed in New York than anybody is Theo Lufke.
Uh-huh.
Okay. And I don't have any problem divulging him because he's a public figure and people know who he is.
We've had two excellent conversations with him, and I think we kept on discovering another round of questions. I think we'll probably go back to him a third time.
Yeah. Theo is a walking Bible on
yes.
this. And I'm not going to, you know, I mean, I've talked to Theo, obviously, about the stuff that I was doing. But in any event, the brief history is that Geithner got worried about all this, I think around 2005,
mm-hmm.
That there was a lot of bilateral CDS going on. He was worried about basically the paperwork, that the banks were not keeping track. And it wasn't computerized. I think a lot of this stuff was on slips of paper, and it was chaotic. And he was worried that in a crisis, no one could figure out ex post who owed who. And so he pushed these guys. This is the very first thing that he did. He pushed them to, you know, clean up their act and, you know, do a much better job of record keeping. And my understanding is that that process took place over a couple of years, and that eventually they got to the point where at least well over 90% of the stuff, of the trades, they could account for and sort of knew who was obligated to who. They were not at 100%, and I don't think even today they're at 100%.
Mm-hmm.
But But at least that was the first thing. Mm-hmm. Just get the paperwork straight. Then, even before the crisis, I think Theo and other people at the Fed had worries about, you know, even with the paperwork fixed, what about the domino effect? And I think they were worried about all that, and they would have liked central clearing. But I don't think they felt they had, and this is now me making an interpretation that I don't know if I have evidence for, but I think they didn't feel like they had the causes belli, so to speak, you know, the actual event to basically it forced these banks to go to central clearing until the system blew up. And so when Bear Stearns blew up, this is even before AIG. I think that sent the Fed into overdrive, and then they started, their effort of trying to get these large banks to centrally clear. And I think the way it started is that they initially cleared through, I forgot the name of an entity. They had an existing entity that was bought out by Ice Trust later on.
Right,
Ice Trust bought. I forgot the name of it. It's in the paper.
It is, yeah.
And so this entity started doing central clearing, or at least started to set up the operations for central clearing. I think it actually operated. But then Ice Trust bought that.
You mean after Bear? You don't mean before that?
After Bear.
Right. Okay.
All right. And then they set up this entity, and they started figuring out, you know, getting it all started or whatever. And either before it started trading or shortly after it started trading, it was sold to Ice Trust, and Ice Trust then had this kicker that they gave the dealer banks 50% of the profits. And there's, by the way, some ambiguity over how much control the dealers still have over Ice Trust. I mean, if you go to Ice Trust, and you obviously should, they will make a very strong argument that. Let me step back. You know, the ICE Trust, which is the clearinghouse for the derivatives between the banks, is owned by ICE, right?
Right.
Which is a company up on top.
Mm-hmm.
And they will claim that the boards of directors of ICE are, you know, not necessarily related to the dealers. It's, you know, it's like any other public corporation, and nothing nefarious about that. And then when you get to the ICE Trust level, I think they will argue that that the boards of directors are quite diffuse of just ICE Trust, and there's a risk management committee at ICE Trust, and I actually think that the guts of actually what goes on in these clearinghouses is controlled by the risk management committee.
Mm-hmm.
That's what my sources tell me. And on the risk and management committee at ICE Trust, I think there are four members, of whom two are dealers, large bank dealers.
But the risk management committee includes people from the dealers.
Yes. Yes.
So it's not an internal committee like you usually think about a risk management committee.
No.
That's odd.
No.
Mm-hmm.
Well, there may be a couple of internal people on there, but my understanding is there are four members. Two of them are dealers. And the ICE Trust will defend that by saying, look, the dealers are our biggest customers. And so, you know, it's in their financial interest, since they're putting up $5 billion, each of them has to have it, each of them have to put up some money for a reserve fund, and they each have to have $5 billion in capital, and they're going to say, look, our users are our owners. And there are actually 13 banks, actually, that technically have, I think, an ownership interest in ICE Trust. Although, as I said, most of the trading activity is concentrated in five of them. And they're going to say, look, since their money's on the hook, they have every right to be on the risk management committee. I know that's what they're going to say. And then they're going to say they only have half the risk management committee.
Mm-hmm.
And so they're going to say the dealers don't control risk management.
Mm-hmm.
And my view is that while they may not control it, if you've got two dealers, very large bank dealers on that committee, at a minimum they have veto power, certainly.
Mm-hmm. So what kind of decisions does the risk committee make?
Okay, so for example, I think it would have been the risk committee that would have suggested there has to be at least a $5 billion minimum capital threshold. Mm-hmm. I think it would be the risk committee that would set the level of reserves that each entity would is supposed to post. And I think the risk committee would control anything about future membership. Because I suggested in my piece that one logical thing for the ICE Trust to do is to open its doors to smaller dealers or financial participants or even end users, and you could tier the amount of reserve requirement or the reserve contribution to the open positions that the various users would have. And confidentially, I have asked, I have had a conversation with ICE Trust since publishing the paper, mm-hmm. And they told me that they are considering expanding their membership. I don't know when they will do it, but then you can talk to them directly and ask them.
So the $5 billion, that sounds like a big amount of money for the broker-dealers to lock up. Did they get a return on their reserves?
No, they don't actually contribute $5 billion. I think they just have to show they have $5 billion in capital. The amount of reserves that they contribute is some smaller amount than that. Uh-huh. And no, they would not get interest on whatever they contribute. That would accrue to the central clearinghouse.
So that's not a very high threshold for these huge institutions since they easily have $5 billion in capital.
Correct.
Okay.
Correct. But at least I make the argument that mm-hmm. up till now, the dealers would have no financial incentive to allow smaller parties or certainly end users directly onto the clearing platform,
right.
Because they want people to go through them. They don't want somebody to go directly to the clearinghouse and bypass the dealers.
Right. Okay. I think while this is really fascinating, I think we really have to focus on pre 2009.
Yeah.
Right. We have a congressional mandate.
Yeah.
Now, by the way, I have to tell you, I was never able to talk to CME about all this.
Is that right?
They never. This is all confidential. They never returned my phone calls, so I wasn't able to talk to them. And
interesting.
And I just had to speculate as to why. Now, by the way, I heard scuttlebutt, without identifying any party. I heard scuttlebutt that one of the reasons why CME has very little business, apart from the fact that the banks only want to. I mean, I make the argument, of course, the banks want to only use their entity because, I mean, it's their clearinghouse. So why should they go to CME when they own something else?
Mm-hmm.
But I'm told that an additional reason is that there were some operational difficulties in CME getting started, and that the CME is not the easiest organization to work with. But I have nothing beyond that.
Hmm.
You know, just vague statements by certain people saying that, you know, that they were not the best run institution, and that could have, you know, that, so in other words, they could have had some self-inflicted wounds. And by the way, I also point out that if ICE Trust were to do what I recommend, mm-hmm. which is open itself up to smaller dealers and also to basically anybody,
mm-hmm.
ICE Trust could if it wants, could end up having a monopoly. I mean, they could get all the business, you know. And that raises the question, a public policy question, if they ended up with a monopoly and CME is basically run out of business, should there be some kind of, you know, quasi-rate regulation or whatever, you know, by the federal government of the monopoly, just as you would have a electric utility or something.
Now, isn't ICE already regulated by the New York Fed? As a settlement company?
Well, when just you like say DTC? Regulated, that is a word that I would put in quotes.
Mm-hmm. We do that a lot here. We do that a lot here.
Yeah. So let me be specific. Under the bill that is likely now to get passed, the CFTC is going to end up regulating the clearinghouses, and they'll have a lot more authority, and it will be explicit in regulating the clearinghouses than the Fed, because in particular the legislation, as I recall, directs the CFTC to at least oversee the margin requirements and the capital rules, and I think any membership requirements of the clearinghouse. So the CFTC would be the big enchilada. Today, in the absence of the legislation, I think the Fed has what I would call moral suasion authority over the clearinghouse. In other words, they can make very strong suggestions about the governance relation, about the governance system of the clearinghouse. They certainly don't have any authority, I don't think, or at least they don't think they have any authority to oversee the prices that they charge for clearing. They would probably have moral suasion authority over the margins and the capital, but I don't think that they've put a heavy hand on that. I think they've sort of left that to the clearinghouse. And so I think the Fed, New York, is being very gingerly about how much authority it asserts for a couple of reasons. A, I'm not sure that they really want to test the bounds of their authority, other than sort of calling people into the room and, you know, pressing them. And B, they know the legislation's coming. And I think they don't want to be perceived as preempting the legislation because, as you know, the Fed itself is under watchful scrutiny by Congress, and they don't want to do anything, I think, that would upset the apple cart that would cause people to say, no, the Fed is encroaching its, is exceeding its authority.
So
they're walking a very fine line.
So some people have made the claim to me that under the margin requirements regulation that the Fed has, which is, I guess, Regulation T and Regulation U, the Fed could have been more aggressive in setting margin requirements in the derivatives business. Do you know anything about that?
I don't know enough about whether that margin authority would extend beyond stocks, because I know they clearly have the authority under statute to do stocks. Mm-hmm. I don't know whether they have the authority to do it in derivatives. I just, they may, but I think the Fed in New York is just very worried about overstepping its bounds. But at the same time, to give them credit, they have been trying to knock heads.
Right.
And they have had regular, semi-regular conversations with the clearinghouse and the big banks about trying to do the right thing. And see, their claim of authority, their major legal hook, is that they have oversight over the holding companies of the large banks, and it's through their prudential authority of regulating the holding company. That I think they assert the ability to sort of get down into the weeds of their derivatives activities. I think that's their hook.
So again, pulling back to pre-09, I guess, at that point it seems that without a clearinghouse, it was really completely unregulated markets.
Yeah, it was the Wild West, yeah.
If we try to kind of tabulate the worst things about that from a systemic point of view, what would those be? I guess would those be pricing inefficiency, lack of margins? How would you describe what was wrong with that environment?
Yeah, certainly there was no margining, there was certainly lack of price transparency, which, by the way, there still is today. And we'll talk about market in a minute, because that's another element of we got to talk about pricing transparency.
So why don't you focus on that? Again, from your article, I wasn't sure what was true before 09, because a lot of this seems to be about development since 09. So what kind of prices were available to dealers and other folks before, and when did that start to change?
Okay, so the only pricing data that are available are from Market, MARKIT, and Market was formed in 2003. It ramped up and I think became a lot more comprehensive in its data reporting, I think, in the last couple of years before the crisis. I can't give you the exact dates.
Mm-hmm.
Certainly they are more important today than they were 3 or 4 years ago, but even then they were the only prices that were available. their business model is they went to each of the bank dealers and they said, if you give us your data, we'll collect data from all the other guys, we'll aggregate it, and we will give you something that looks like an aggregate end-of-day price. And I'll get into what I mean by that in a minute. And so the reason why you, Bank of America or JP Morgan, should give us the data is that this is a way for you to look and get data from everybody. And then, oh, by the way, once you give us the data, when we give it back to you, we're going to charge you. So they charge each of the banks, and they charge the users, and they charge the hedge funds, and anybody else who's active in this market, they charge them. And it's not clear exactly how much, but I think it's, you know, something like $100,000 a year or something like that. And so market then provides these end-of-day prices. Now, here's the problem. For one thing, I don't think they report, let's say, the very last. Let's just take, for example, a CDS index or a named CDS on General Motors or whatever. I'm not sure that market provides the very last trade at the end of the day.
Mm-hmm.
I think what they do is they aggregate somehow and give either a plain or a weighted average of sort of what the prices were, sort of like in the last hour or in some of the last, toward the end of the day. It's never clear exactly to me. I haven't been inside market, and you clearly need to talk to market about their methodology.
So they would talk to you?
I couldn't get through to them.
Hmm.
But I had other people who were very active in the market tell me exactly what they... I mean, in a way, I didn't need to talk to them.
Mm-hmm.
And by the way, I was very nervous about talking to them because they're under antitrust investigation by the Justice Department. And I figured that since they were under investigation, they would not talk to me, especially since I was a former antitrust official. And if I were them, I would never talk to me.
Right.
That's for sure. for that reason.
I'm not sure that's why they know.
Huh?
I didn't know you were formerly an antitrust investigator.
I was a former number two person in the antitrust division, and in the Clinton administration. And part of my life was I didn't finish the investigation, but part of my supervision, I helped supervise the investigation of NASDAQ. So that's why I know a lot about these kind of markets, because this sort of conjured up to me in the images of.
Right.
Of NASDAQ, which in a world, you know, ages ago did not have price transparency at all, and you know, Justice and the SEC had to fix NASDAQ. Okay. But in any event, I didn't call market because I figured they wouldn't be straight with me, and they just wouldn't talk to me, for very good reasons, because they'd be scared to talk to me.
But Bob, do you happen to know, do they collect volume information as well as price information?
Yeah, they do.
Okay.
They do, and they have an algorithm that somehow weights the prices by volume. I'm not sure exactly how, and then it gives you back a price at the end of the day. But it is not, you know, what we would normally think as the last ticker price of a stock. All right? That is not what the price is. All right? And here's another important thing. I am told that a lot of the trades or the prices for derivatives or CDS in particular, and by the way, I think that market is overwhelmingly a CDS price reporting agency, not interest rate swaps or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's mostly CDS. It's not entirely CDS, but in any event, a lot. Since they're relying on the dealers to give them the prices at the end of the day, some of the prices that the dealers give them at the end of, let's say, Monday, are not Monday's transactions. They're Friday's transactions that they just basically, because of their computer system or God knows what, did not fully incorporate and have done at the end of Friday, so they lump that all in with Monday's prices. And conversely, or likewise, some of Monday's prices don't get recorded at the end of Monday. They get swapped over until Tuesday. So the price that you're getting on Monday night is a weighted average of some prices on Monday and perhaps some prices on Friday.
Right.
So, and the dealer, and by the way, the market participants all know this. They know that the price they're getting, that, that market's giving them, in some respects, is not only aggregated, it's stale. And I was told that the banks themselves do not use market prices to mark their books every night. That was what I was told. In part for this reason, because they know the prices are stale and aggregated. And so that should lead you to ask, well, why in the hell do they buy the price information from market? And the answer has to be, it's better than anything else. And it at least gives them a second check on their own internal prices. So it's sort of like a CYA kind of thing, why they buy the price information. But I don't have to tell you, from what I've just described, this is a long way from the kind of price transparency that you would get on a futures exchange or a stock market, where you see the ticker down and you have post-trade transparency immediately. And what the bills require, and what, you know, what the Dodd and Lincoln bills require, is that the CFTC is supposed to implement or force the clearinghouses and or the exchanges to implement a system of post-trade transparency so that you get price reporting as close as possible to right after the transactions take place and not till the end of the day.
So I guess the credit default swap market only really took off around 2003 or early 2000. So the market kind of responded to that development with this product.
Correct.
So when it comes to other over-the-counter derivatives markets, what's the source of pricing information?
I don't know.
Okay.
I don't know. And, I think one thing that I haven't been able to nail down is to what extent people use the information that's in DTCC's warehouse. Now, I know less about what's in DTCC, but what I'm told is that everybody's supposed to report everything to DTCC, but I think their data are available only on a weekly basis, certainly not nightly. And I think they're more comprehensive. But beyond that, DTCC is going to have to tell you.
Bob, stepping back a bit, wasn't there also an argument that ABX and CDX and some of these other indices, which is what market was collecting data on and disseminating, you know, leaving aside sort of the sloppiness of one day versus another, that the prices for those indices were, in some people's view, not representative of market prices for all the underlying single name positions, and
right.
Therefore the existence of ABX, etc., led to greater uncertainty, led to led to people marking their books down more than they had to. Have you thought about that?
Not enough.
Okay. Or related issues.
Not enough, but I mean, you're clearly moving in the right direction, and you know this is also going to slop over into the accounting discussion, and we'll have separately, but. To the extent to which ABX prices were then used to mark to market,
right.
You know, people, and I mean, but you know, I have heard the same thing, that the ABX indexes. By the way, another thing I want to tell you, and I'm pretty sure I'm right, is that the indices are all constructed by market.
Yes.
Okay. And they claim intellectual property in all the indexes.
I think that's right.
Big time. And they construct them, and I don't know anywhere you can go to find out how they're constructed.
I think there's a dealer poll of of what single names to include in each index, and they change the makeup of the index every 6 months, or they did. There is a primer on the market website that I haven't gotten through.
Okay.
Completely.
All right. It's just something I just didn't have the time to do. And by the way, there is the issue of staleness in the indexes too, right? Because you would be getting prices of different things at different times, I think.
That's certainly true. I would suggest that the different technicals in the index market may be a bigger issue than the day-to-day sloppiness.
Right.
Going back to sort of bigger picture, if we might. One hypothesis is, and maybe this leads too much into the accounting discussion tomorrow, but that that part of the role of derivatives in, if you will, propagating rather than causing the crisis is the lack of transparency of pricing, but over a longer period of time, not just day to day. Then secondly, the interconnectedness comes from comes from the posting of margin and which you also talked about in your paper.
So
sort of stepping back to a little bit bigger picture from where we were on market, and I apologize if I'm throwing off a train of discussion that you wanted to follow through.
No, just going wherever you want.
Do you think that those were important or just part of the story? Were they important propagating mechanisms? Is that something that we should really focus on in the derivatives discussion?
Okay, so I'm thinking out loud. I mean, up to now I've thought about derivatives as a facilitator to these instruments, the mortgage security is getting created, and therefore the subprime mortgage is getting originated. And you're asking, would they have propagated the crisis? Well, they would have propagated the impact of the crisis or the impact of the losses to the extent that they enabled financial institutions to have more leverage. So think about that way. Maybe there's another chain of causation or another chain of impact that they have. But I just
it's sort of not just the gasoline, but the spraying of the gasoline over a wider area to try to continue your analogy.
Okay, so in that sense, you're saying that basically what they did is they gave comfort for a lot more people to buy this stuff. Right. In other words, it gave comfort to the rating agencies, which as long as it was AAA, then any German bank or some Finnish township could buy the stuff. So in that sense, more people could buy this stuff than would otherwise be the case, and I think derivatives contributed to the ratings, which allowed that to happen. See, but the ratings is crucial. I don't have to tell you. I mean, nobody at the end of the chain who was buying the crap would have bought it without the rating agencies.
I guess I'm on a somewhat different hypothesis, so allow me to try to explain a little bit better. That it's more folks didn't know, financial institutions didn't know where the losses were, how much the losses were. They were afraid of the margin that they had posted and losing it if bankruptcy and dominoes of bankruptcy started happening. So that the existence of the, and I'm just spelling this out because I don't have great expertise about the margin requirements, but I noticed that you wrote about this. That part of the events, if you will, of September, and to some extent part of the reason why the Fed stepped in regarding Bear Stearns, was the just great uncertainty that resulted from this bilateral opaque market with not knowing real values and not knowing who had margin, you know, how much margin was with someone else. Although maybe that's completely wrong because the main dealers didn't post margin with each other. So,
Let's start now. Okay, so the main dealers, the big five, or even if you spread it out to, let's say, the Big Ten globally or whatever, my understanding is they did not post margin with each other. All right? Because they all felt that they were, you know, so big and, you know, well capitalized, they didn't have to worry about it. And then so the only people that were posting margin were end users, either end user hedgers or end user speculators. But even among those, if you're Berkshire Hathaway or General Electric, my understanding is you never had to post margin either. All right. It was the kind of people that were in the Big Short book, you know, the lone wolf speculators out there, they had to post margin. And if you're a smaller company, a manufacturing company, and you had a derivative, that Goldman Sachs was going to require you to post margin. Now, it turns out that one exception to this pattern is that Goldman Sachs, of course, required AIG to post margin. Which, of course, you know, with the proximate, you know, that's what everybody's bitching about, you know, is the claim that Goldman, you know, it was the margin or the collateral call that helped bring down AIG. It's an interesting question why AIG was held to post collateral and some of the large non-financial guys were not, or like Berkshire wasn't required to post margin. Why was AIG required to post margin? I don't know the answer to that.
So did the ISDA master agreement, and this is, we're only talking about credit derivatives and we're talking about margin.
Right.
Right, or are we talking about all over-the-counter derivatives?
Well, that's true. I mean, we're only talking about credit derivatives. But even, for example, in a highly customized deal, I mean, when I'm saying Berkshire Hathaway, I'm thinking of Warren Buffett's famous put, which is not a credit derivative; it's just a bet on the stock market.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm sure there are other kinds of customized arrangements. I just don't know all the ins and outs.
Mm-hmm.
But all I know is if you're a heavyweight and you wanted to have a specialized deal with Goldman Sachs or whatever, if you're a heavyweight, they did not require you to post margin.
Even in the credit event.
Well, in a credit event, maybe. I guess, you know, if AIG was required to post margin, maybe everybody was. But my understanding, according to people in the market, is still not everyone was required to post it.
Okay.
So, example, I'm just giving you as an example. If General Electric bought CDS protection on some of their suppliers or their, you know, because they worried they were going to go under, I'm not sure General Electric was required to post margin, even for credit derivatives. I'm not sure that that's the case.
Like on day one, they don't have to post margin.
That's
but
right.
The credit
but,
event,
but,
they might.
Yeah, they might. They might. It may be that AIG was required. The reason why AIG was required is simply because of the volume of how much they were doing.
Hmm.
That may have been the reason. But, you know, Kim, your larger point is that pre-crisis, I think you're right. I don't think anybody in the regulatory community had any idea who was, you know, of who was posting margin and who wasn't. I mean, I don't think anybody knew because the market was totally unregulated. It was the Wild West.
So the big players wouldn't post margin day one, but maybe a smaller player would be required to post margin day one?
Right, right.
I see.
But nobody knew.
I just assumed.
Right, and nobody knew who was connected to whom. Like they might.
Well, that's
know.
Another thing.
Right.
Yeah, that's another thing. For example, Goldman Sachs would not know for, let's say, Bank of America's customers. I don't think they would know, you know, which of Bank of America's customers were posting margin or not. I don't think they would know that.
Right.
And so, just to finish the point,
please.
One of the virtues of central clearing, at least, is that everybody who goes to the central clearinghouse, everybody knows what the margin rules are because they're all spelled out.
Yeah,
so at least everybody knows that.
So you had said in the book that Europe was way ahead of us. How far were they already doing this posting margin regularly before the crisis?
That's a very good question. My understanding is that well, the short answer is I don't know I don't know how far ahead of us they were in margin. But my understanding is they were, but you know, you're gonna have to ask them directly.
Okay.
I just don't know.
Okay, what do you look at? Is this here a help or just another oligopoly?
Say that again.
Is the a helpful force here?
Or
are they a cartel like market?
Oh, okay. So, yeah, I was very careful, of course, in using the word club and not cartel. But, you know, you guys have made the logical leap, which I'm not going to dispute.
We're probably not going to do it in print.
No, I understand that. That's why I used the word club.
Yeah.
I think club has a nicer ring to it and doesn't sound so evil. You know, by the way, I mean, this is something that, see, I have no direct knowledge of, but clearly, I mean, look, I mean, I don't have to tell you, you're not the Department of Justice, so I'm just telling you, if I had my former Department of Justice hat on, and I look at the paper that I've just written, I would say my paper says there's a lot of smoke here. There's no fire, there's just a lot of smoke, which suggests that they all have reason to behave as if they were a cartel. It does not mean that they were actually communicating with each other and agreeing on anything.
Right.
I don't have proof of that.
Right.
But let me put it this way. It would not surprise me if they were talking to each other about, you know, whether it comes to, you know, who should belong in ICE Trust, how we should be dealing with customers or whatever. I would find it hard to believe, actually, that these five banks and the people who were participating were not talking to each other about market structure. It almost, to me, given the number of fora in which they were meeting in ICE Trust, they were meeting at ISDA, they were meeting at the Federal Reserve in New York, they all went to the same conferences, they all talked to each other all the time, every day. It almost defies credulity that they weren't talking to each other about things that you and I would call antitrust behavior. But I have no hard proof of that.
Right.
I see why you wrote this paper and why you were the best person on the planet to write it.
Yeah, that's sort of why I did it. And by the way, just to give you some background, you guys, just so you'll know, do you know about the NASDAQ investigation?
We didn't, no.
Okay, just so you'll know, and sort of what led me to this, NASDAQ, in the old days, before there was electronic trading, it was a market just like the derivatives market, where people would call each other up, and there were dealers in stocks. And so there would be certain dealers in Microsoft stock or Dell stock or whatever, and they all knew who each other were, and they would talk to each other. And some heavily traded stocks, there were like 15, 20, 30 dealers. So it was a lot bigger market than this market, which is only five, let's say. There was a paper that was published in the mid-90s by two finance professors at Vanderbilt, Christie and Schultz, that did an analysis of the spreads on the top most 100 the top 100 most traded stocks on NASDAQ. And what they found is that the spread between the bid and the ask price was always quoted in even eighths. In other words, in, there was, you know, 2 eighths, 4 eighths, 6 eighths, you know, et cetera. There was never a spread that was in the 16ths.
Okay.
Or even an odd eighth, like 3 eighths or whatever. It was always even eighths. And they did this, they did a statistical analysis, and it just jumped out at them that basically, unlike all the other stocks where the spreads were all over the place, on the top 100, they were all the same. And so they came to the Justice Department, us, and presented this evidence, not the professors, but plaintiff's attorneys. And I have to tell you, when I asked the people there, I said, well, how many dealers are there? And they told me, oh, there could be 20, 30 people. You know, my instincts were, how in the hell can 20 or 30 people fix a spread? It's almost impossible. You never heard of a cartel that big. So I didn't believe them. But nonetheless, the data just sort of, they jumped out at you. Something was wrong. And so the same thing happened to the SEC, by the way. They were talking to the SEC. And to make a long story short, DOJ launched an investigation where we subpoenaed all the voice transactions, the conversations of all the dealers. There was a lot of that stuff to go through, needless to say. And basically what we in the SEC found is that if any dealer on a top-quoted stock tried to offer a spread that was different than an even eighth, they would immediately get shouted down by the other guys in curse words. And by the way, 85% of all the words on the tape were curse words.
Yeah.
I mean, Kim will know this from being having worked in the investment banking world, obviously. It was amazing, actually. But basically, if somebody quoted a different spread, there would immediately someone else would jump in, and they would say, basically, if you ever do that again, we'll never do business with you again. Except they would do it in curse words.
I gotta ask, what's the harm of everything in eighths? I gotta ask.
Huh?
What's the harm of everything being rounded in eighths?
Well, the problem is that it would mean that somebody who wanted to quote a tighter spread or basically a smaller markup, like let's say somebody just wanted to basically buy a stock at only a 16th markup rather than a full, you know, one quarter and even eighths. That means that if that person does that, other people will start doing that, and then basically the spreads will narrow. All right,
well,
customers will get a better deal, but then the dealers won't make as much money. All right, so this was a massive, unbelievable, multi-year conspiracy that was exercised through intimidation. But they never actually got in a hotel room and said, we're going to fix the price. They just sort of, in the course of practice, they threatened each other if they ever departed from what was became the industry norm. And so we sued them, and the SEC sued them. And to make a long story short, the way this market was fixed and why this is very relevant for OTC derivatives, and it's why I did this in OTC derivatives, basically, is the SEC adopted in 1997 something called the order handling rules. And this was on NASDAQ, and what the order handling rules said...
I'm sorry, what year was that?
1997. And what they said is that if you're a market maker in a stock, you have to post in a public fashion, and that by that time the internet existed, you have to post basically on the internet what all the other limit orders were for buying and selling this particular stock. And what that transparency did, it would enable somebody who could then go and look at the internet and say, look, I can buy Dell at maybe only a 16th markup rather than a full quarter point markup. And once that happened, the whole system collapsed. And they couldn't collude with each other because transparency, this is called pre-trade transparency as opposed to post-trade transparency. Pre-trade transparency then led to the rise of the electronic communications networks, Archipelago and Island and a bunch of others that were eventually bought up by the stock exchanges. and it allowed these electronic exchanges to match identical offers to buy and sell stock. And that just eliminated the cartel. And it's a classic example of how sunlight and transparency can basically obliterate cartels.
Have you read a good article that goes through that history? That would be a helpful thing to catch up on.
No. No, there is no article that says that.
Nobody's talking
about it. I have looked high and low for it. All you have is my word.
You may have to write it someday.
I may have to write it. Now, let me just tell you, though, I cite in my paper, there are some analytical works that have been done on the trace system that was done for bonds, where basically they went to a system of, I think, post-trade transparency. And the bonds, by the way, in the old days, they were just like OTC derivatives, and it was, you know, there was no reporting of prices until at the end of the day, et cetera. And the trade system was introduced in the several years ago, and
that, I think.
Huh?
It was only introduced in like in 03 or 04, right?
Yeah, exactly. And there's been academic work, and I cite some stuff on trace, and it's also discussed, I think, in the Squam Lake report. There's a Squam Lake report on derivatives. And Daryl Duffy knows a lot about this, too, at Stanford. And I think it's the consensus of academics that when we went to trace, it narrowed the spreads and did all the right things, basically. And so, you know, by the way, I think I do quote in my paper, I have a footnote of the spreads having narrowed in NASDAQ after the order handling rules went into effect. So it's well known that this happened. And so this is why NASDAQ and TRACE are great examples of what will happen to OTC derivatives once they're cleared, traded, and have post-trade transparency. Ideally, we'd even get pre-trade transparency, but we're not there yet.
Okay. And again, I mean, this is fascinating. How do we tie this back to the crisis? And I guess the lack of transparency certainly seems important when it comes to the credit default swap market.
Yes.
Is this one of the arguments that's been made is that after Lehman's failure, the lack of transparency about credit default swap prices created some contagion?
Well, contagion, it also creates litigation. It creates uncertainty, etc. And I guess when you're let me put it this way. I think the connection to the crisis is that the less transparent the prices are, the more difficult it is for people to set margin accurately and on a timely basis. And the less accurate margin is, the more susceptible the system is to going under, basically. So that's the link. Now, did all of this lack of transparency mean that we had a crisis? I mean, my view is, this gets back to the role of bond insurance versus CDS. I think if we had never had CDS, I think we would have had probably more bond insurers writing contracts on insuring this stuff than would have otherwise been the case. We may not have had the volume that we had, but I think given the fact that the bond insurers were so desperate to get into another line of business, I think we would have had a lot of this activity take place anyhow, but probably not as much.
So I think one thing you just inferred was that the additional transparency of pricing would have caused there to be less credit derivatives written. Is that true?
Not necessarily.
No, okay.
I mean, I think, for example, I think you could make the opposite argument. I think that if there had been more transparency, their people would have felt more comfortable about entering into these contracts. We would have more of them, but we would also have had them margined and much more effectively, so that we wouldn't have had to worry about the AIG kind of cascade. We would have had a more liquid market in them, if you will. Because I actually think if you look at TRACE, and you also look at NASDAQ, I think all the volumes in bonds and I think in stocks actually increased after we had more transparency. I mean, it's common sense, actually, right? I mean, you're going to be more comfortable trading a transparent document than I mean, instrument than something you don't know what the price is.
So, Bob, going back to your bond insurer point, have you sort of played that out, thought about that more about sort of state regulation of the bond insurers or other aspects of state law and how that might have, you know, without CDS, if we had been just dealing with the bond insurers, how that would have played out?
Yeah, so this is a really important subject that I haven't fully researched, and that is to get to nail down the volume of bond insurance that was actually written. And, you know, there are only a limited number of these guys. You know, it's AMBAC and, you know, MBIA, et cetera. These guys, and I don't think there's been enough of a focus on the state regulation of these guys, which would have been the New York State Insurance Department, right?
Yep.
And I don't think they have gotten nearly the attention that they deserve. I mean, they have flown under the radar, and everybody's been criticizing the OTS and the federal regulators. And I mean, I wrote something back right after the crisis on the bond insurers in my piece and saying, you know, where were these guys?
Which piece was that, the origins of the crisis?
Yeah. Yeah, and I don't know enough to know. I mean, I think one of the things that constrained the amount of insurance the bond insurers wrote on this stuff is that CDS was an effective substitute for them. But I think there was a significant amount of bond insurance written because we know they almost all failed, right? I mean, there was a crisis, shortly after September 2008 in the bond insurance community.
Yep.
And in fact, I remember that's when Warren Buffett started his new bond insurer. They were all worried that there were going to be no bond insurers left.
Yeah. Have you read anything good that's been written about that one?
No. Nope.
That's another one I would like to really quickly catch up on. My vain hope.
There's so much, Bob. How do you sleep? We're struggling with this issue ourselves.
Oh, listen. I mean, I just. You know, I don't have a full-time job to look into all this, but you guys do. This is your job, I guess. But this is one area which has not been fully explored, is bond insurance regulation and all that. And because they made all the same mistakes that the rating agencies made, every single one of them, the regulators and the bond insurers, how they could write insurance on this with no data, basically.
Right. So, okay, moving on. So we're going to try to get... If we were to try to get information from the market and DTCC about derivatives pricing information, during the crisis, do you think that's even feasible? And
yeah. Oh, well, I'm sure. You guys have authority. I mean, you guys can. They'll talk to you.
But do you think that? I mean, so they were keeping it. They just weren't releasing it to anybody before.
No, I don't think. I mean, if you go to Market's website. There is no way you can. By the way, if you go to Market's website, you won't even figure out who owns them.
Right.
Trust me, I tried. Yeah.
So if you had a chance, what would you ask them if you were us? I mean, what's your wish list?
Okay, so I mean, first I would try to find out their ownership structure.
Mm-hmm.
To what extent the dealers own them? I would like to find out. Well, I think you need much more, I think you need them to walk you through exactly how they set prices. And you subtly ask them about stale prices without accusing them of anything. You just want to act stupid and understand how they do this.
Mm-hmm.
I think it will become evident in their descriptions that these are not, as I said, transaction prices. There's a lot of data manipulation that goes into figuring out how this is done.
And so DTCC has essentially the same information as Market? I mean...
So DTCC, I think, does.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm not sure how it shows up in their database. So Kim asked a question a while back about volumes. I am almost 100% sure DTC has volumes. I don't know how they aggregate it, whether they only collect volume data, daily. I don't know if they have it by counterparty. At what granular level they have it.
Mm-hmm.
So do they have the tape equivalent of every single transaction, or is there aggregation that takes place, and then the banks give them all the data aggregated somehow, and at the end of the day, I think you need to get in there and basically have them show you exactly how their what's in their database. And here's another thing. The dealers are involved with DCCC too.
Yeah.
Okay. And, you know, as I said in my paper, DTCC has a joint venture with Market, whose dimensions I'm not fully aware of, but it certainly suggests to me that if the dealers are heavily involved with Market, and Market is involved with DTCC, DTCC is an obvious potential competitor to Market because they've got all the data.
Right.
And I think there's a reason why DTCC does not sell data to any third-party provider out there. It's because the dealers somehow don't want them to do it. I mean, but if you have to ask yourself, if DTCC has all this gazillions of data, why wouldn't they sell it, you know, to third-party vendors?
So why would DTCC?
That's a very good question.
I guess step back. I don't understand why DTCC, you know, during the crisis would have had data at all if all the trades were done, you know, on a bilateral basis. Or does their database begin in 08?
You're saying their database began in 08?
I'm asking. I don't know.
I don't know. I think they have data. I think they have data that go before that.
Okay. Well, we'll have to ask them.
You'll have to ask them, and this is like a big, big question mark.
Okay. Well, I guess we'll talk to you again.
Bob, thank you very much for your time and insights, and
right.
To be continued.
Yeah, thanks
yeah,
very much.
The only thing I can say. Yeah, by the way, the only reason I'm envious of you guys, and trust me, I'm not envious of you guys, but the only reason I am envious is that you were in a position to get more information about subjects that I was not able to in writing my paper. I went about as far as I could, and only because you have the authority that you know, are able to get people to answer questions, you can go the next step.
So, in that sense,
I'm envious.
We have thoughts about that, but if you want to help us think about what data requests we haven't yet made and ought to make, that would be exceedingly helpful, and we'd be...
Yeah, but I think you've written most of it down. I think you want to find out in the case of I think in the case of DTCC, you want to find out what kind of data they have, when do they start collecting it.
Yep.
I think you definitely want to ask them, have they ever thought about selling it to third-party vendors?
Right.
In any form, has any third-party vendor ever approached them about it?
I meant even more broadly, Bob. So that was sort of a big picture, if you care to think about that question.
Okay. All right.
All right. To be continued. Thank you very, very much.
Thank you.
Okay. And I'll talk to some of you guys, I guess, tomorrow.
Yes.
That's right.
Right.
Thanks.
Thanks.
Bye-bye.
Okay.